My name's Darryl Hill. I'm an airline pilot by profession, and in my off days, I restore, rebuild and operate historic aeroplanes. The plan at the moment is, having seen some of the celebrations that have been conducted overseas, what we'd like to do, and we are trying to do, is execute a drop of poppies over the ceremony itself. This has been done many times overseas, but we've never done it in Australia. There's a whole bunch of hoops I'm having to jump through, lots of approvals to get, but we have ongoing efforts to make that work.
When you say poppies, explain what sort of poppies?
We've been ably supported by primary schools across the state, the War Widows Guild, and we have all sorts of people involved in this. And the idea is we have to drop things that are safe for the public. We can't use the familiar poppy that you'd see the RSL selling because A, it'll damage the aeroplane, and B, falling from a great height, it might injure someone. So we're having paper poppies cut out, and they are going to be inscribed. We've asked kids to investigate a veteran, dedicate their poppy. The whole idea is to try and link our centenary this year with people. It's very easy to get into the technology and the statistics of this whole stuff, but when you get into talking about human beings, opportunity was just too great to miss, connecting young people now with people they've never met over 100 years ago. Well, actually, on 100 years ago.
Explain what a poppy will actually look like. How will the name be put on that?
You can imagine what the RSL sell. It goes on your lapel. And we've basically had artwork done up to show that in plan form. And kids will colour it in. And on the back, they'll be invited to investigate names. 7,000 odd names there in the Cenotaph on North Terrace. They can do internet searches. Find someone. Maybe they've got a deceased relative, an ex-serviceman. I want to dedicate it to great-granddad, whatever it might be. Something personal, the personal connection.
And because the centenary is in regard to the signing of the peace treaty following World War I, can they put the names of relatives and loved ones from other conflicts on the back of their poppies?
We're quite happy to have that. The idea is to get a connection. Yes, Armistice Day and the follow-on Remembrance Day is World War I specific event, but we see that in order to promote the connection across time, if that results in a veteran from World War II, I personally have no problem with that at all.
So, listeners, if you are in the city on Armistice Day this year, which is the 11th of November, and you see poppies on the ground, pick them up, have a look for those names on the back, and remember those people. How many poppies are going to be dropped?
A little bit open to discussion at the moment, depending on approvals. The initial plan was to drop one for every South Australian casualty in World War I, which is around about 7,000. The end game could be up to 59,000, which is one for every Australian serviceman and woman casualty in World War I. The numbers are pretty eye-watering. In this case, eye-watering for the Adelaide Council. We're going to have to clean up the mess. But, you know, it does depend on how we do our trials, see where they go. The idea with a lot of drops from aeroplanes is stuff is to be dropped in a specific location. We're not trying to do that at all. We are just trying to stain the sky with this red stream. And once you've seen it once, it sticks with you forever.
What time is this drop going to occur?
Subject to my navigational skills, I think, Helen. The plan at the moment with the RSL is 11:01 and 30 seconds after the minute's silence and the bugler doing his thing.
We usually have a glorious RAAF aircraft fly over, but this isn't going to be dropped from one of those, is it?
No. The plan is, through some friends of mine, we're going to put hopefully four tiger moths over the top of the wreath-laying portion of the ceremony, because there are precious few actual World War I aeroplanes left to fly. So they'll be going over first in salute, and then later on I'll be doing the poppy drop, which is a Cessna 180, which actually served with Australian Army Aviation in Vietnam.
And what year did it serve in Vietnam?
It arrived in 1966, and it did three tours in Vietnam, and it left in 1970.
1966. How did it get to Vietnam, and what month?
Yeah, that would have been June. It had a boat trip on HMAS Sydney. 161 recce flight had been over there prior to that, but they had a limited number of aeroplanes. And the 180 and a number of extra helicopters were sent over to expand the aircraft holdings to facilitate their efforts to support 1ATF.
And you say recce squadron. What is a recce squadron, and what did this aircraft actually do?
161 recce flight was part of Army Aviation that was constituted to actually go on active service to Vietnam to support No. 1 Australian Task Force. The job of 161 recce was basically anything and everything to support the army effort. The Sioux helicopters were used for a lot of low-level work, often in face of considerable opposition. The Cessnas were given different tasking. I've got a little bit of a list here. First and last light patrols, they had basically a thing called Line Alpha, which is 5,000 metres around the Nui Dap perimeter. Even though 161 served at a number of different places, this particular patrol tended to occur after they got to Nui Dap. And they were worried about VC mortar teams coming in overnight, so they'd do a check first thing in the morning and last thing at night, make sure nobody's setting anything up for surprises overnight. Visual reconnaissance, awful lot of that. That's what the Army specialise in with their fixed-wing assets, low-level. The concept of the forward air controller, it's a little bit different to that, but broadly, great familiarity with your local operating area, you can pick up changes. Road reconnaissance, convoy escort. We're familiar with watching IEDs go off in Afghanistan. Same thing. These guys would be ahead of a ground convoy looking for potential ambush. They do communications relay. When guys are out, the radios we'll talk about a bit later, but the Army radio communication system was quite poor in Vietnam in a lot of ways. And in order to get communication sometimes from one side of a hill to the other, you needed an aeroplane to be in the middle to take the signal from one and then rebroadcast it to t'other. They did light transport around Phuc Toi to Saigon, Binh Hoa, sorted other places in the Saigon area. Did continuation training because Major General Vincent decided he wanted to learn to fly. Artillery observation, they did a light strike. They armed the aeroplane while they were over there with rockets. They often flew around with the doors off, and I was actually talking to Norm Coleman from the Walkerville RSL the other day, who was regaling me with tales of firing his grenade launcher and M16 out through the open doorway.
Out of a Cessna.
Mm.
Oh, goodness.
One of the very interesting things they did was a thing called Airborne Radio Direction Finding, ARDF, and it was top secret. And the missions came to be known as shush missions, because whenever anybody raised it, somebody in there would go, shh. So they became known as shush missions. The idea with this was now Australia's really good at this sort of stuff when you let people have their head. Australia developed a radio direction finding equipment at WRE at Salisbury. It was hand-built. I actually had a look at the drawings in the archives the other day. It's quite interesting. And this gear was operated by a chap who was so big it filled the right-hand front seat. Chap in the back operated it. And he was a specialist from 547 SIG Troop. And the pilot would fly around doing some fairly precise navigation. And they'd be able to intercept enemy radio transmissions and end up with what we call, in aviation terms, a cocked hat. You'd end up with three lines. And at a small point, you go, pretty confident the transmitter's there. But some very interesting ops with this. For example, prior to Long Tan, they reckoned that 547 had located the inbound enemy force, but the intelligence community discounted it because of lack of corroborating evidence. The aeroplane, and if you ever see it, it's got a Snoopy painted on the side. And I often wondered why that was there. And I was at Avalon a couple of years ago, or last year, and a chap from 547 SIG Troop came up. We had a lovely chat. I said, maybe you can tell me. Well, I was Snoopy on the side of this thing. He says, it's obvious. I said, well, fill me in. He said, we were snooping around. And there was Snoopy in the Red Baron. It was a popular tune at the time. So ARDF was very important. They also did flare missions. Believe it or not, a Sioux at low level at night as a gunship, and the Cessna would fly over the top chucking out flares so that the guys could see what was going on before they strafed it. They did trials with things like a starlight scope, looking out the window at night. We've all seen NVGs on the television, but a starlight scope was actually a single tube, a monocular, that was used on an M16, an automatic rifle. They basically took it off the M16 and they would have a guy looking out the window with this thing at night. And they did some trials on it and fairly quickly binned it because, to quote the trial, it resulted in unbearable eye strain and nausea after 5 minutes at 1,000 feet. So, yeah, not so good there. And a bit of psychological warfare stuff as well, chucking out leaflets. At one stage, they had speakers mounted on the aeroplane. That quickly was a job sent to the helicopter section. And I think from what I've read through archival research, that sort of got discounted along the way. The active part of the flying effort for 161 became, as time went on, more and more right up there in the face of the enemy, supporting the guys on the ground, because that's what they were there for.
What an incredible little working aircraft, a little Cessna.
Yep.
And it's going to be flying over Adelaide on Remembrance Day, dropping poppies. What a fitting tribute, not only to those people whose names are going to be on the poppies and who we must remember, but also to the aircraft itself.
Interesting you say that, Helen, because it wasn't until I actually sat down and did some plotting out of what was going on that I realised this aeroplane was actually in Vietnam on the 50th anniversary of Remembrance Day. So it was actually on working. Active service halfway between now and then.
Does the aircraft have a name? You don't just call it Cessna, do you?
Well, that depends on who you talk to.
Is it an airworthy name? Yes, it is.
If you talk to my wife, it's called Algae. And everybody says, is that because it's green? I say, no, because we have an old biplane, and that's called Miss Scarlet. So, a.k.a. everybody says it's Biggles Aeroplane. So Biggles and Algae, if you're a W.E. Johns fan. So amongst the family, it's Algae. However, the call sign of 161 Recce in Vietnam was Possum. And when we rebuilt the aeroplane, we took the opportunity to re-register it. So now it's Papa Sierra Mike. It's a possum, so we call it Possum.
Fitting name. Now, Possum has a plaque.
Possum does have a plaque. The big issue, I said before, it's easy to get into the technology and the statistics of all this stuff, particularly with something like rebuilding an aeroplane that when you're trying to return it to its in-service configuration, museum quality we're talking about here, it's very easy to paint something and make it look close enough, but we're into doing it right. And every one of those aeroplanes that we've done has had some sort of dedication plaque in it to the veterans. And 161 Recce lost three guys in Vietnam on ops, three pilots, Major George Constable, the CO, Captain Barry Donald and Lieutenant Alan Jelly. And we've got a plaque in the aeroplane up in the left-hand wing root, which at a glance doesn't look like anything, but once you read it, you see that we are committed to commemorating the memory of those guys, and indeed all Vietnam veterans with the aeroplane.
Do these chaps' families know that there is a plaque in the aircraft for them?
I contacted all of the next of kin before we did it to get their approval, and they were all very happy to give it.
Have they visited the aircraft?
Alan Jelly was, after his accident, was buried at Terendak in Malaya, and he was one of the guys who was recently repatriated to Australia. His family lives here in Campbelltown, his sister, and we are in close contact with them. Likewise, Barry Donald, which has quite an interesting story to it. I mentioned I was at Avalon recently and standing by the aeroplane, answering questions from the public, and this chap turns up with his young son, his teenage son, and I thought, crikey, you look familiar. And he introduced himself by Christian name and said, my dad flew these things in Vietnam. And I said, okay, in that case, please come under the fence. Come in here, you get special treatment. And we had a great talk about the aeroplane itself. And in the course of that, because I'm interested in the people side of things, I said, what was your dad's name? And he said, Barry Donald. I said, oh, can you do me a favour? Oh, what's that? I said, can you look inside that cockpit and have a read of the plaque? And I can still see him. He looked inside, he looked at the plaque, he looked at me, he looked at the plaque, he looked at me again with this quizzical look on his face. I said, yes, mate, your dad flew this one. And this guy must have been about my age. So he was perhaps an infant or a young kid when his father went overseas and never came back. And he looked at me and he said, can I sit in this? I said, mate, if you don't, I'm going to be really upset. And so he jumped in and I told his son to get in the other seat because I said, your granddad flew this aeroplane. And he had a good look around. But when he put his hands on the flight controls, I was just too slow with the camera because the look on his face was something to behold. He was connected to his dad. It was an amazing sensation for him as well as me, but it was so great to see that all of the effort we'd put in meant so much, even if it was just for one person.
We sometimes forget, in amidst all of those statistics of battles and wars that our troops have gone to, participated in, we forget that human element, don't we? And how it affects generations to come.
Indeed. I look at my grandfather. He was part of the first wave ashore at Gallipoli. Survived the Western Front as an ambulance man at Pozieres and gave up trudging through mud and decided to learn to fly. And then had a crash at the end of the war, lost his medical and got sent back to the mud. And I think, how would I have dealt with that? Not just having my career taken away from me, but like so many people back then, mixed emotions, the loss, it's indescribable. It really is. It's just pain, suffering, getting over that. We talk about greatest generations and people who are more resilient. Well, yeah, okay, people were different in days gone by, but they were all affected. We need to remember that.
Absolutely. You have aircraft and Air Force in your blood. Your dad served as well, didn't he?
Yeah, my dad was an infantryman. I don't know whether I can say this on the radio, but he always called himself a six-bob-a-day murderer.
It was wartime, yes.
It was wartime. He was a forward scout in New Guinea and did some other quite interesting stuff, but it stayed with him forever. I can remember him telling me stories when I was a teenager before I joined the Air Force that he wouldn't repeat to me in later years. But when he turned 90, we were all perplexed as what to get a 90-year-old man for his birthday. So I made a PowerPoint presentation of his life and contacted everybody I could back to his youth. And we had a marvellous party at my sister's house and went through the PowerPoint presentation. There was a chap he knew there from the RSL in Melbourne who was the next brigadier. He came up to me later and he said, "I never knew all those things about your dad."
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, you know, quiet achiever, a bit like BP."
A bit like BP.
Yeah.
I have to tell you something else about this Cessna of yours. You said it arrived in Vietnam on the HMAS Sydney in June 1966.
Indeed.
So did my husband.
Well, there you go. He had a great escort.
He did. Yes, he did. Okay, so we've examined this delightful aircraft, the Cessna, that we're going to see over Adelaide skies on the 11th of November. Let's have a look at a bit more about your background, if you don't mind, Darryl. You served in the Air Force. What caused you to join the Air Force?
Well, I always wanted to be in aviation. Obviously, there's a bit of a military strain running through my family. Like every little kid, I always wanted to be a fighter pilot. Every little kid wants to be a fighter pilot. I joined the Air Force in 79. I did some quite interesting stuff. Most of my time was flying P-3s here in Adelaide, and I got out in 89. Actually, my XO ensured I did 10 years in one day. He said that was insurance for the public servant, so I got my long service leave.
Now, the P-3, that's the Orion, isn't it?
Yeah, which is about to end its days, in fact. There's a big celebration up in Edinburgh in November this year, in fact. P-8's already started to arrive and replace it.
We will do a separate interview about the Orions because they're so beloved by South Australians. But let's go back to that little Cessna. How did you come to own Possum?
Yeah, interesting story. As I say, we have a biplane, and it's actually the second oldest flying XRAF aeroplane. We rebuilt that over 15 years. It's a historic artefact in itself. And my wife loves it. The analogy I use is, okay, have you driven down the South Eastern Freeway? Yes. Have you done it in a convertible? Yes. Have you done it in winter? Yes. With the top down? No. Imagine it with the top down and you're in your underwear. That's how warm it is in this aeroplane because you have wind blasts, there is no heater, there is nothing. With retirement looming, I said, I don't want a caravan, but I'd like an aeroplane I can go places in. And Catherine agreed and said, I've got two requirements. One is it has to have a roof and a heater. And I looked around and I was actually looking for a Cessna 185, different aeroplane completely. And I got in touch with my engineer mate who had rebuilt the Avro. And he said, well, actually, have you thought about a 180? I said, no. And he said, well, I'm thinking of selling mine and it's got to go to a good home. So if you're interested, you can have first refusal. I've got to hand it to Nick. He certainly knew what buttons to push. Because, I mean, the aeroplane's still liberally coated with bullet holes and patches. Some of them were actually obtained on my 9th birthday. And I've spoken to the pilot who was flying it back then, which is another story in itself. So the aeroplane had come out of the army in 75. It had been fairly well mucked about with by civilian owners since then. We got it in 2013 and spent a couple of years putting it back into its configuration as used at Nui Dat 1967, Film Town Nui Dat 1967. It's a lovely thing. It is indeed a lovely thing.
And do you go off on trips in it?
Yeah, we haven't for a while because my mother got ill. That was sort of the focus shifted a little bit. But Avalon, as I said, Echuca, we've done for the Antique Aeroplane Association. And events like Armistice Day, Remembrance Day.
It's going to be great. Darryl, there is another aspect we need to talk about, particularly in regard to small aircraft. I've flown in a few, and I think without exception, I've been sick in every one I've flown in. The Air Force have a cure for that, don't they?
It's not 100% effective cure, Helen. When I started my pilot training, you know, it was not uncommon for some people to be less than happy in an aeroplane. And air sickness did actually lead to a couple of guys getting failed off the course because they never got over it. But in the interim, they were sent to the Institute of Aviation Medicine, where they had some devilish devices which were used to desensitise you, spinning chairs and assorted other things that you eventually got sick of being sick. But some people, as I say, they never got over it and they weren't able to function in an aeroplane effectively. But you can make anyone sick in an aeroplane. I mean, I've been sick in an aeroplane. When I got to Edinburgh and I was the third pilot on the crew, I got sentenced to the ordnance area on the P3B to help out the guy down there load sonobuoys in the middle of some aggressive anti-submarine warfare prosecution. And trust me, you'll probably last 5 minutes doing that. And then everybody goes to the bag.
And some recover and some don't.
As you say, yes.
Darryl Hill, thank you very much for coming in today. And we look forward to seeing you flying over Adelaide on the 11th of November.
We are looking forward to it as well, Helen. Just a few hoops to jump through between now and then, and we'll be there.
Lovely. Is Possum able to give us one of those wing waggle things?
Absolutely. Can do.
Great. We look forward to it.
Okay.